Hello, VetBlast podcast listeners. Did you know that you can earn 0.25 CE credits with this podcast? After listening to this podcast, head on over to dvm360.com/flex and then sign in or register for a free account. Then select the podcast and follow the online prompts to claim your CE.
Hello and welcome to the VetBlast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the VetBlast podcast. Do you know all the latest advancements in the treatment of parvoviral enteritis? Well, we're going to chat about it. We want to thank our friends from Elanco for sponsoring this session, and joining us is the one and only Dr. Kristen Zerson. How are you, my friend?
Well, I am doing great. How are you? I'm glad to hear you're excited to talk about some parvo today.
I am, and I'm just equally honored to share a little bit of the screen with you. So
that's very generous.
Yes, I'm kind of geeking out, so don't mind me.
Oh, you're very kind. Well, I'm excited to be here. Usually people can't match my enthusiasm for parvo, so I'm excited. I'm excited that you're excited.
Well, because I'm excited that finally we have a great treatment that's there. So I'm looking forward to learning more about it. So to our listeners, about Dr. Zerson, Dr. Kristen Zerson is an assistant professor of small animal emergency and critical care at Colorado State University's Veterinary Teaching Hospital. She obtained her DVM from the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, completed her rotating internship at VCA West Los Angeles Animal Hospital, and her emergency and critical care residency at Colorado State University. She is a diplomat of the American College of Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care. Dr. Zerson's professional interests include infectious diseases, fluid therapy, and sepsis. And if you don't get a chance to listen to any of her lectures, my friends, you got to. They're absolutely fantastic. So, okay, just a little plug for you because I really learned so much from you. All right. Well, we got a lot to cover, my friend. So let's just get into generally speaking about parvo. So as a criticalist, you must see your share of parvovirus. So how common is this disease?
Absolutely. And we certainly see it, but I know everybody else out there is seeing it. Certainly, criticalists are not the only ones. In fact, we probably manage a very small subset. All of our colleagues out there in shelter medicine and general practice and specialty hospitals, I think we all know it is extremely common. You know, it's interesting because parvo isn't reportable, so to get numbers is pretty tough. So again, since it's not reportable, we don't have any really specific numbers, but again, we are all seeing it. For us in Colorado, it's mostly during the spring and summer, but for a lot of our colleagues where it is sunny year-round, we see it year-round. But we also know, right, we're probably not seeing a lot of parvo as well, right? Some patients are just not going to show up to our hospital. So I think bottom line, there's a ton of parvo out there. We're seeing a ton of cases across the modalities of hospitals, right? Across the spectrum of care. We're just seeing a ton of these cases. Would you agree? Do you see everyone else out there seeing it a lot?
Yes. Well, we were literally just talking about it this weekend, and it's probably the single most common infectious diseases that we're seeing more of that's on the rise. I mean, I know we as veterinarians, we deal with quite a bit of infectious diseases in veterinary medicine, as you know, but still, I think one reason parvovirus really does stand out to me is the mortality rate is as high as 91% if untreated in some of those studies. So does your experience support that statistic?
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, that's the frustrating thing with parvo, right? Is that if we don't treat it, the mortality is so high. The good news is that with treatment, we can have really good outcomes, but treatment can be expensive, right? I mean, certainly parvo can present in a variety of ways, right? We have our relatively stable pups that we catch early and we can do some outpatient treatment and they do great. But then on the other end of the spectrum, critically ill, they're in the hospitals for days. I know at our hospital, that's going to cost thousands of dollars. So although it's good news, our treatment options, it can be really limiting. Not all of our families can afford to spend thousands of dollars to keep their pups in hospital for days on end. I think that's really been the limitation, the ability to provide care for all of these families who care about their pups so much, right? I mean, everyone wants to do the best by their pups, but are you guys seeing the same kind of costs when you're having to keep these kiddos in hospital?
Yes. You know, it's a big thing. The cost is a huge issue. And we're also noticing, as you probably know too, is the impact that this is making on the family. Wow. You know, it chisels away at the human-animal bond a little bit. So I was curious to get your thoughts on that. So how can that diagnosis of parvo and treatment adversely affect the human-animal bond?
It affects the family so much. Yeah. But I also don't want to forget, it affects our teams, our nursing staff, our support staff, the veterinarians. Of course, we care so much about our clients, and these clients, I mean, think about it. These are puppies. They're usually new to the family, right? So you have a new addition to the family, because a lot of our clients, this is family. And so you have a new addition to the family. Everyone's falling in love with this little pup. And then all of a sudden you get this diagnosis. And in those cases where, again, we're talking about, we have to make this big financial investment that is not possible for everybody. I mean, that's devastating. It's absolutely devastating to the families. These families, they want to provide the best care, right? I mean, we don't question that. They want to do what's best. They want to do everything that we recommend, but it's just not always possible. So it just puts these families in such a difficult situation. And similarly, I mean, our staff, our wonderful technicians and support staff and veterinarians, I mean, we can work tirelessly on these kiddos, and it can be very emotionally and mentally taxing and draining to lose one of these pups that we work so hard on for so long. But I agree. I mean, I think the impact on these families is just really incredibly devastating. It's not something we prepare for, right? At least not me. Is that something you're prepared for when you bring a new kiddo home?
No, never. And, you know, I always think of too, if they do survive parvo, it's such an imprinted situation on a family that they will always say, like, this is Molly. She's a parvo survivor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right? I mean, that's exactly just, right.
It's never just Molly. It's Molly, the parvo survivor, because just to your point, it really creates such a ripple effect in the family on what that has done to their human animal bond.
It's been such a emotionally, financially taxing experience that it's something that really sticks with you for sure.
Yeah. And I want to chat a little bit more about the diagnosis too, because, you know, we have access to in-hospital point of care testing to confirm the diagnosis, but is it always like a snap, or are we missing cases of parvovirus? Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I think we're all doing a snap test, right? And if it's positive, it's positive. I wouldn't second guess that at all in our clinically affected animals. I mean, I wouldn't run around doing snap tests on pups that don't have clinical signs, but if they have clinical signs and you do a snap and it's positive, then it's positive. On the other hand, though, if it's a puppy and they have clinical signs of parvo and it's snap negative, it's still parvo, right? We still have to treat it as parvo, because if we guess wrong and it is a false negative, I mean, we're going to be spreading that throughout the hospital, throughout the community. So I always say, if it walks like a parvo, talks like a parvo, if it smells like a parvo, then it's parvo, you know, until proven otherwise. Again, just because of how transmissible it is, we need to be exceedingly cautious. So absolutely do those snap tests. But if it's negative and you're really thinking it's parvo, then just treat it as such, right? Don the PPE and use isolation protocols so that we don't end up with some big outbreak.
Right. Is there any other supportive evidence out there, whether it be clinically and or diagnostically, that we can use, you know, to help in diagnosing the disease?
Hopefully I'm not the only one, Dr. Christman. Hopefully you've done this too, right? You get the dog come in, it's 5 years old, has bloody diarrhea, tramp it around the hospital, go get radiographs, take it outside, go visit in a room with the owner, come back in one of your kennels, it has diarrhea. You move it to another kennel, has diarrhea there. And then you get the CBC back and it's neutropenic. And you're like, oh gosh, I didn't, right. It's parvo, right? And so those ones sneak in the door, especially those older dogs where it's not high on the list. And so one thing I commonly will use to support the diagnosis is that neutropenia or the low white cell count, the leukopenia, because it's something we see pretty commonly. And so again, sometimes that's what kind of tips it off, especially in those populations that we may not always have it on the top of the list, right? Those older dogs that have diarrhea.
Absolutely. And, you know, currently, what are the mainstays of current canine parvovirus treatment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the frustration, I think, I wonder if you share this frustration, is we just have to let the virus run its course, right? Yeah. All we can do is support them. it's going to attack their GI cells. They're going to have horrible diarrhea and vomiting. It can attack their bone marrow. It's going to make them really sick. And previously, it's just, you know, what we have to say to the family is, you know, we just have to let it run its course and we have to support them. And that still will remain a really important component of treatment in parvo. I think three main reasons parvo puppies die. One is hypovolemia. And so we know fluids are a mainstay of treatment. So really important to make sure these patients are fluid resuscitated, that they have a normal blood volume, that we get them rehydrated. Even an outpatient, sub-Q fluids, really important because we know they're losing so much through their GI tract. Second reason would be hypoglycemia. Some of these micro mini teacups, all they have to do is miss one bite of food and they're hypoglycemic, right? Yeah. And so really common that these puppies are hypoglycemic. So making sure that we keep their glucose levels normal. And then the third would be sepsis. So these puppies, if they have normal white blood cells, then they should be able to fight infection. But what we know is that parvo attacks the bone marrow. And so if these puppies are neutropenic or leukopenic, we have to prescribe antibiotics. We have to. If you can't monitor white blood cell counts, you have to prescribe antibiotics. Because again, if this is an outpatient protocol, you're not going to be monitoring the white blood cell count. So you have to prescribe antibiotics. So I think those in terms of life-saving are imperative. But if I had to say, I think the most underestimated would be nutrition. We're learning more and more about nutrition in veterinary medicine each year, not just in parvo, but there's evidence in parvo for sure as well that it is just so vital. It is so vital. The only way we can feed those enterocytes and get them to regrow and heal and maintain all their barrier functions is to provide nutrition. How are you providing nutrition in your hospitals?
If it's pretty bad, we've done feeding tubes for them. It's so important.
Absolutely. Yeah. I really common the NG tubes, right? They're easy to place. Yep. And so to easy. Me, an NG tube just makes it so I can make sure they're consistently getting nutrition and it's not in a way where, right? I mean, we've all felt sick. No one likes to have food put in your face when you're already feeling sick. So I like that. Of course, not everyone can do an NG tube though. So if you have to syringe feed or something, it comes with risks, but nutrition is just so darn important.
So important. What's your thoughts on antibiotic use and like, what are you using? Because, you know, generally speaking for puppies, you know, you have to kind of be cautious of which ones that you're going to go to, but I'm curious to get your thoughts on like what class of antimicrobial do you reach for?
You know, antimicrobials are such an important just topic in general in veterinary medicine, where we're really starting to focus on antimicrobial stewardship and making sure that we're using antibiotics appropriately as a whole. And so, you know, I mentioned that, you know, sepsis is absolutely one of the reasons that these puppies die. And so it can play a really vital role in these puppies. You know, the interesting thing is that we're really targeting secondary infections because antibiotics don't treat viruses. But if puppies have functional immune systems, if their white blood cell counts are normal, their neutrophil counts are normal, they can fight those secondary infections. I think about those puppies as our HGE, right? So you have a 7-year-old German Shepherd with bloody diarrhea. We have a lot of evidence to say they don't need antibiotics. So it's not just the bloody diarrhea. It's the fact that they don't have a competent immune system. So if they are neutropenic, leukopenic, I personally use Unison. It's pretty broad spectrum. It does have some protection against E. coli, which is, of course, one of those bacteria we worry about. So for me, it's Unison. Suboxetine is another good option. So that's what I'm reaching for. Again, Unison has pretty broad coverage. And again, I personally don't add in Enro. Enro would really be trying to target that E. coli, which again, Unison does have some pretty good coverage against.
Yeah. I mean, we could talk hours about this too, about like, you know, the microbiome and how this affects all that. And I think the research is still coming out there with all of this, you know, with what we're seeing.
We have to get away from that concept of antibiotics don't have downsides, right? You're not just killing the good bacteria. I mean, that microbiome is so important.
Right. I remember sitting in one of Dawn Booth's sessions and she's really like hones it in on matching the bug to the drug.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. Match the bug to the drug. Exactly. That's a great philosophy.
Yeah. And I do think from what we're just chatting about, these are current pain points that we experience with parvovirus, because we're kind of treating necessarily like the symptoms, not necessarily the disease, right?
Absolutely. And that's been the hang up, right? So we provide the fluids and the glucose. And if they need antibiotics, we do that. We, of course, treat the nausea, right? Multimodal approach, right? Let's get them Meropenem and ondansetron and metoclopramide, and we provide pain medications, but we haven't targeted the virus, right? All we're doing is saying, well, this is terrible and it has to run its course. And so I think that's been the major hang up with parvo treatment. I mean, we haven't seen major advancements for decades. I mean, it's really been the same for decades in terms of just supporting these puppies, which was the best we've been able to do up until this point.
Right. Up until this point, but Dr. Zerson, there's good news for the profession.
There is.
Yeah. So tell the listeners a little bit about the newest advancements surrounding the treatment of parvovirus.
Yeah. So the new release of canine parvoviral monoclonal antibody, really exciting, because now we're finally able to say, let's target the virus. Let's get to the root of the problem. Let's target the virus. So it is the first and only USDA conditionally approved antibody in treatment for parvovirus, which is really exciting. It's a single IV dose given as early as possible in the course of disease. So right after you make that diagnosis, administering, I'll say CPMA, since canine parvoviral monoclonal antibody is a mouthful. But the point is here, the antibody targets the virus. So it binds the virus and prevents it from entering into those GI tract cells where it causes all the damage. So really binds it to neutralize it, which is just really exciting to finally be able to, again, target the virus, not just the symptoms.
And historically, to the listeners out there, we've been familiar with monoclonal antibodies now for quite some time. I mean, on the human side, I know for years, but you know, up until the veterinary space, I think we're pretty familiar with how those work. Would you agree?
Yeah. You know, it's like the other monoclonal antibody treatments out there. There was a viral infection that the world faced recently that you may have heard about monoclonal antibodies for as well. And there are actually hundreds of them in human medicine now, but we're getting more and more in veterinary medicine, which is exciting. So antibodies work, you know, the same way. So the idea is that the antibody in the bloodstream, when we administer it IV, it's in the bloodstream, it binds that virus, it surrounds that virus. So it really prevents the virus from entering its target cells. And with parvo, of course, we think about the enterocytes, the GI tract. So it really acts to neutralize the virus itself, which again is quite exciting.
Yeah, very exciting. And you mentioned it's a one-time injection, right? It's a single dose treatment strategy. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. It's 0.2 mils per kg and it's a one-time IV dose. So again, you know, that's nice as well, right? We're not talking about every 8-hour dosing. We're not talking about now and tomorrow, right? It's a one-time dose as early in the course of disease as possible. So you place that IV catheter to give some IV fluids, to maybe get the dextrose on board. And then at that time, again, you're going to give that single dose.
I don't have any experience with it yet, but I'm excited to. But I'm curious to see how does the CPMA single dose IV injection administration compare to the other current parvovirus treatments that we've been doing. I'm sure it's going to be a game changer, obviously, but what has your experience been with that?
Yeah. You know, the benefit, one-time dose, anytime we can give something one time, that's right. Huge, right? And thinking, we think about traditional treatment now, right? We're talking about days, whether it's outpatient or inpatient, right? These things are lasting days. But, you know, I think the most important, you know, message is that we talked a little bit about how antibodies work. What they don't do is treat dehydration. They don't increase glucose levels. So this should be added in addition to our current treatments, not in place of our current treatments. So we are still placing the IV catheter. We're still giving the IV fluids. We're still giving the anti-nausea meds, but we are going to add CPMA into this treatment protocol. And we're going to reduce the duration of clinical signs, right? Hopefully these puppies are going to become less sick. Hopefully they're going to become less critically ill. And again, if we can resolve some of our more common symptoms early and get them out of the hospital sooner, that would be outstanding. So again, I really want to stress that antibodies don't restore blood volume, right? So it's targeting the virus. We still need to do our job in treating these clinical signs.
And so I know you've been using it at, mm-hmm. at CSU. So what has your experience been like for you? And also I'm curious to get your opinion from the team as well.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So we've been using it outpatient and inpatient. So as part of our outpatient protocol, we'll come in as soon as they're diagnosed. You know, they have their IV catheter, they're getting a little bit of fluids. Like I said, if they need dextrose, they'll get that. They're getting the CPMA injection, and then they're going home with their sub-Q fluids. They're going home with their meropitant, with antibiotics. And so we've been adding it on to outpatient treatment. And then we've also been using it on our inpatient kiddos as well. So same thing, as soon as they're diagnosed, we're getting that IV catheter in, we're getting the CPMA administered. And then of course, the IV fluids, resuscitation, all of those things. So it's been going quite well. We haven't had any problems. The administration is easy. It's stored in the freezer. So as soon as we get a positive, our next stop is the freezer to get it out. It takes a few minutes to thaw. And then we're administering it, like I said, a one-time dose of 0.2 mils per kg. So it's been easy to incorporate into our current standard of care. And I think that, you know, again, the important thing is there's always spectrum of care, right? That's our job as veterinarians. Of course, there's the gold standard, and that's not always feasible or reasonable, right? And so we have this wide spectrum of care where we're able to really help support our clients in being able to care for their pets. And we know that yeah. that's going to look different. But I really think this can be incorporated in many of those tiers when we think about that spectrum of care.
And you had me at single dose injection, you know, it's whatever.
Yeah, I know.
I think of that. I think of the skin cases and so forth. Right. Like, it, to me, they're like crock pots. You set it and forget it, you
yes,
know, and
love that.
Talk about like compliance and adherence and all those things. It probably goes even up higher knowing that, you know, you have control of that compliance a little bit further for treatment. So
absolutely.
I think that's really awesome.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to know more about the studies. Particular, there's this great pivotal efficacy study. There was some really powerful data out there. Can you explain a little bit more about the mortality rates between the control group and the CPMA-treated dogs?
Yeah, absolutely. So in order to get the conditional approval from the USDA, there are very specific studies that have to be performed. And one of them is this efficacy study. There were 28 puppies in the study. They were exposed to parvo, and there are 28 of them. 21 of them were given CPMA only. So they only received CPMA. They didn't get IV fluids. They didn't get meropitant. The other seven puppies were the control group, and they did not get any treatment. Again, I want to clarify that that is not how it's intended to be used. That's the study that's required by the USDA. So that's what's required. So again, the 21 puppies that received CPMA only, none of them died. None of those puppies died after having parvo and being given CPMA. Unfortunately, as we know, we talked about the mortality rate earlier. Unfortunately, four of the seven puppies in the controlled group did die. And again, that's again what we know about the mortality rate and not getting treated. That's not unexpected. But again, I think the great news is none of the 21 puppies that got CPMA died. And in addition to the mortality benefit, the puppies that received CPMA had significantly faster times to resolution of vomiting and inappetence. So if we can get these dogs to stop vomiting sooner, if we can get them to start eating sooner and get them to start feeling better sooner, that's going to potentially translate to being in the hospital for a shorter duration of time. So again, the efficacy study was pretty powerful and really exciting. Not only the mortality benefit, but again, that's what keeps them in the hospital, right? How many times right. you have to keep these kiddos in the hospital because they're still vomiting, they're not eating. So again, with the CPMA, they started eating sooner, stopped vomiting sooner, their lethargy resolved. So just kind of a marker of overall feeling better. So pretty exciting.
It is very exciting. We were talking a while back with Dr. Chris Paco, behaviorist, about this using CPMA and the fact of what that means for, you know, from a behavioral perspective, that these puppies, when they're not desensitized or exposed, that pivotal moment that you see, you know, when they're puppies, the fact that they can get home closer or be home closer with their owners and go back to training or whatever that is, or just being exposed to substrates. That's so crucial, because I know from my experience with parvo puppies, they've had some behavioral issues because of the fact that they weren't exposed to much when they were puppies, right?
And I think that's so important, because, you know, sometimes we can get pigeonholed in our, you know, we're treating parvo, and we don't think about all of the other implications, right? All of the other implications on the family and the support system and on their long-term behavioral effects, right? If these puppies are, unfortunately, right, they have to be in isolation despite the best nursing care possible, right? It's impossible to ensure that these animals, they can't be socialized in the hospital. They can't be getting the affection and love and training that their family can provide. So really thinking about the larger impacts of parvo is really significant. That's a wonderful point.
Yeah, I'll share this story with you. I don't know if I told you this before. I had, when I was general practice, I was years ago, I was also doing shelter medicine in the same town. And wonderful family that adopted a puppy, ended up having parvo. We did all the wonderful things, you know, weeks of therapy. Puppy survived. But what ended up happening, months go by, this puppy had horrific separation anxiety. Lo and behold, they never told me, but that puppy got returned back to the shelter that I was at. And I was like, oh my gosh, after all that work. And I share that with you because you really do not realize the impact that something like CPMA can do for the human-animal bond. Like, yes, you're so worried about treating the disease and whatnot, which is so important. But then from the behavioral perspective, right? Like, look at the impact that this can create.
The ripple effect, right? The ripple effect of what being in the hospital 5 days versus maybe 2 days. I mean, you know, we don't know. It's going to vary from patient to patient, but just think again, if they can be out of the hospital sooner or just feeling better sooner, right? That impact of being able to see your puppy bouncing around, getting the zoomies outside, you know, and just feeling better, right? That makes us all feel better. So yeah, the ripple effects of parvo, I agree. Sometimes we don't consider, you know, how far that ripple really extends.
So knowing all of this, then, are there any reasons not to include CPMA into your treatment regimen?
Yeah. Oh, good question. It's currently licensed for puppies over 8 weeks, 8 weeks of age or older. So currently, if you have a puppy less than 8 weeks of age, then it is not licensed for use in those puppies. Otherwise, parvo positive puppies, 8 weeks of age or older, great addition to your current standard of care or your current treatment plan. Again, adding on CPMA, not using CPMA in place of our current treatment. So as long as they're parvo positive, 8 weeks or older, add it into the plan.
Okay. Love it. So, you know, you and I have been on the other side of the exam room table making this diagnosis to the pet parents. And when they hear that, because it is something that they know about, they hear of it, they freak out. You try to talk them down. I would love to get your communication soundbite, if you will, of how you communicate this strategy easily and effectively with clients who are very emotional and often concerned even about financial responsibility.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's so hard because everyone kind of knows about parvo, right? And they know that it can be fatal. And again, we've already talked about how devastating that diagnosis can be. And so, you know, I think as all of us do, we have to meet our clients where they are and talk about the difficult conversation of finances. It's a reality of veterinary medicine. So first, just describing, you know, the spectrum of disease in parvo and what are some of the difficulties we may face in the road ahead, and then really talk about what is our best option. You know, our best option is going to vary, depend on the patient. We said there's a wide variety of disease, so that's going to vary quite significantly, but really developing, you know, the best plan we can. And then again, assessing where our owners are at in terms of their ability financially to invest in that care. And of course, we can adjust our plan based on that. You know, in terms of adding CPMA in, Of course, there's a cost associated with CPMA, but if we can see that benefit on the backside where maybe they respond well to outpatient treatment with CPMA, maybe we can get them out of the hospital sooner and feeling better sooner. I know if you can get out of the hospital even one day sooner in my clinic, that could be, you know, a quite significant cost savings. So again, talking about how that might benefit their specific pup, I think is a really important part of the communication.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you're at CSU and at the teaching hospital, and you know, how do you foresee CPMA fitting into the general practice setting?
Exactly the same, right? I mean, we're all seeing these pups, and whether they walk in and, you know, overall aren't feeling too bad, let's add it into the outpatient protocol, right? Sometimes they need to stay in the hospital with you for the day to get some IV fluids, add it into that protocol. If you're going to bring it in and hospitalize that kid overnight, add it in. You're going to bring them in and you're going to transfer them to the emergency clinic because you're not there overnight. Add it in. So again, I think this applies to all spectrum of care, right? Whether it's shelter, inpatient, outpatient, I think it can really be impactful in the entire spectrum of care.
Yeah, I love that we're talking about spectrum of care too. It's just so popular nowadays and important that we're talking about it. And this is what I love about veterinary medicine, how it's evolving. You know, I know at DVM 360, when we did the press release on this, this was, I think it was the highest, it was the highest traction post that we've received. Just to give you an idea of the impact that this is making in the industry and in the veterinary profession. And people are writing into us and they're saying, oh my gosh, it's about time. What a game changing this is. Mm-hmm. This is going to make me even more excited about practicing and treating parvovirus. So How do you see CPMA changing the industry regarding the standard of care with canine parvovirus patients?
I mean, it's the first big advancement we've had, right? So, and again, this is the first time we're actually targeting the virus. So I think it's going to become standard of care, right? It's going to be added to the standard care protocol, which includes all the things we previously talked about with fluids and pain meds and antibiotics. And it's going to be included in the standard of care, again, at all spectrums, right? At all levels of care that are required. I think it is going to change. It's going to add to the standard of care when it comes to treatment of parvo, which is exciting, right? We haven't had an advancement in this area in a long time. So it's about time, and I'm quite excited.
Yeah, we all are. There was a veterinarian I was chatting with at a conference, and she said that she compares this to when people didn't believe back in the day that the stethoscope wasn't going to be a thing, you know, like, one's going to use this thing around your neck. And, you know, and she's like, now I go into a room, I feel like I'm lost without it. And
Exactly.
That went out, right? And now when parvovirus comes in, she's like, this is going to be the new standard of care. We're going to be talking about this, like looking at 10 years down the road, like, oh my gosh, what did we do without this?
Exactly. Right? How did we practice without CPMA? I agree.
Yeah. You know, as we're wrapping up, what final thoughts on this, the fact to the listeners that are very excited out there to learn about this, if they have a little bit of a hesitation, you know, sometimes us colleagues, we get a little skeptical about trying something new or whatnot. I know we covered the studies, we covered the use. What would be a piece of advice you would give to a veterinarian that's interested in adopting it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, like I said, I think a great place to start, add it into your current protocols. We didn't talk much about the safety studies, but very minimal potential side effects, very self-limiting, maybe some injection site reaction, but self-limiting. It is a safe product to add into your protocol. And we're going to continue to gather more data, right? More research is going to be down the pipeline, I'm sure, for many groups across the country. And that's always going to be a great addition. We'll be happy to see that continued clinical research, but knowing that we have conditional approval, but from the USDA, right? That's not something that comes lightly. There is work that needs to be done to show the safety and efficacy of these products. So with the conditional approval by the USDA, I personally feel very comfortable starting to implement this and add this to my treatment routine.
You heard it here, listeners. Worded Criticalist, Colorado State University, Dr. Kristin Zirsten, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. It was so wonderful chatting with you. Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to seeing everybody out there sometime soon.
Absolutely. Like I said to the listeners, please get a chance to catch her at any of the sessions. She's around the country and around the world speaking, and she's such a great lecturer. I learned so much from you. I really do. So thank you for all the great work you do.
Thank you so much. It was nice chatting with you.
Likewise, my friend. And thank you to our friends from Elanco for sponsoring this session. Don't forget to rate this podcast as always. It helps us out significantly. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast Podcast. Take care, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast Podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay pawsome.